Okay, so in your read, reflect, and applies, what did you guys note about the book of Daniel? Well, sorry, in your reads. We'll start with read. Basic observational stuff.
It's a confusing book.
It's confusing.
And then it goes into prophetic, so it's hard to classify it.
And where does that change happen? Yeah. Yeah, so Daniel 1 through 6 is amazing, and Daniel 7 through 12 is apocalyptic. The whole thing is, of course, amazing, but 1 through 6 is much easier to get at the amazing part. 7 through 12 is a lot of beasts and a lot of confusing things that happen, but it's amazing. Once you work through the difficulties of it, it's still amazing, but just in a less direct way. But yeah, that's fascinating, that arrangement. It is more or less chronological, so it's not that like 7 through 12 is some kind of big flashback or something in Daniel's life. It doesn't work that way. It's chronological, and yet it is divided in that type of literature. What else about read as we're just thinking big picture about Daniel?
The story that we see in the first six chapters, the stories plural, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the lion's den, and everything.
Yeah. You're saying just like it's got really distinct, separate stories. Is that what you meant? Yeah, that's very true. Testing those?
Protecting.
Yeah. Both are true, but yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, to Katie's point, yeah, so each chapter is its own very distinct story. That's interesting. So the stories don't cross chapters. Obviously, the chapters came much later than the book itself. But there are these very distinct, kind of very developed stories that you have in the book of Daniel. And then, yes, when you get to themes, maybe we can, let's hold off on that one, Daniel, David, till we get to reflect. So anything else about read, type of literature, who, when, what, why? What about the who? So one of the big who's in the Bible, of course, is the figure Daniel. So what do we know about Daniel?
Taken from Israelite in captivity in Babylon.
Yeah, and where in our timeline here, where would that be, more or less?
722 BC, right?
Good guess. That's Assyria, which is the northern captivity. We are actually dealing with the southern captivity, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. So 586 is basically when the captivity is complete. But it starts kind of in 606. There's waves of Israelites that end up being taken and brought to Babylon. It seems like Daniel's in one of these early waves. And random guess how old he might be at that time. 7 years old seems young. What's if you're trying to predict his age at the beginning of the book, what are some things you would want to take into account?
What king was reigning and like whatnot?
Well, there's the king. There's kind of a big fact. If you only read the first six chapters, you didn't get this. But so you got youth. So you have some comments about these guys being young. Kind of you're trying to get the best and the brightest. The Babylonians are trying to get the best and the brightest of the Israelites. But later in the book, you get a big clue that tells you that he was probably young. Any guesses on that?
Early 20s.
Early 20s would be possible. So one of that clue is in chapter 9. So it's kind of subtle, but so as he's praying in the first year of Darius, and we'll talk about who that Darius is in a little bit. So he's king over the realm of the Chaldeans. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the number of years that according to the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. So he's alive when that 70 years has passed. All right, so he goes to Babylon early in the captivity. And then 70 years later, he's praying at the end of the captivity. There's no record that he's going to actually himself return to Jerusalem, but it seems like this is his prayer of, okay, Lord, you said we'd be here for 70 years. It's been 70 years, and now deliver us. Have mercy on us. So that's a clue that Daniel would have been very young at the beginning of his time in Babylon. Because he had been there for 70 years. So somewhere 10, 15, 20 years old, maybe think teenager. We don't know exactly, but that's how old Daniel, so your age, right? More or less your age, when he goes to Babylon. And he distinguishes himself because he's intelligent, bright-eyed. He's responsive, a quick learner. And so with his friends, they become chosen by Nebuchadnezzar for all these special assignments. Anything else with Daniel, the person, that we want to highlight? Nebuchadnezzar, what about him? So he's another central figure in this, especially in the opening chapters of Daniel. What do we learn about Nebuchadnezzar as the story progresses?
Seems at times he's like a very godly king, and then other times he's like, build me a giant altar made out of gold that looks like me. So
yes, so he's a mixed individual. Yeah, anyone else? Nebuchadnezzar?
He's a very mighty king. It takes a lot to humble him.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, I mean, at that time, a king would have been a very powerful figure, and he would have his dominion would have been fairly large. So that was one of the ancient superpowers. So when you're the king of Babylon at that time, that was a big deal. Kind of like Pharaoh in the time of Moses, that would have been a big deal. So those guys didn't tend to be quiet and humble in their demeanor. They tended to be mighty and proud. It was sort of part of the deal. And of course, everyone around them treated them that way, right? Like they were not just a little bit important, but more important than anyone else and anything else in the whole world, basically. And so we'll get to kind of the rise and the fall and the rise of Nebuchadnezzar as we go here. Any other figures you want to highlight? Maybe Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What do we learn about them? His three amigos, that's right. Yep, anything else?
They're brave. They're brave to stand up for what they knew was right instead of worshiping an idol. They knew that they were going to be punished for it.
Yeah.
And they still went through with it.
Yeah, they give one of the great speeches in the Bible, actually, as they stand against the king. We'll look at that speech in a little bit, but it's amazing. And what they do is amazing. And the Lord really honors them for it. Great. All right. So, in terms of who wrote Daniel, Jesus tells us that Daniel wrote Daniel. And so that's a good clue that Daniel wrote Daniel. And then the book itself has all these records of Daniel's visions and recording it, writing it down. And so there's a first-person element to it. That doesn't mean that an editor, after the fact, couldn't add words or sentences here and there. But on the whole, this is definitely the work of Daniel. And that would put him writing it in the 500s, right? So when the final form of Daniel is given to us that we have in our Old Testament, maybe shortly thereafter, but basically this is a work from the 500s BC. And so just starting with that fact, so if Daniel is writing, we'll just stick him right here. So if Daniel's writing there, in terms of interpreting Daniel, what are some big things we want to remember? This is kind of, where in salvation history is a book written, or are the events described? So big picture, what's significant about this era here that we want to recall? Okay, you've got captivity, and we'll look at that. We'll look at the why of the captivity. Huge deal. The temple was destroyed, right here. Temple was destroyed and then rebuilt. T2 was there. So the T1 is built here and then destroyed there. So by this question, what I'm talking about is, so you kind of just don't forget the obvious when you're interpreting the Bible. So this is way after Abraham, right? So Abraham is here. Abraham, we get the three big promises. You get the land. You get the people. These are the three big promises to Abraham, and then a blessing. Through you, I will bless all the nations on earth. So the land is a big deal. So when the people go to captivity, are they in the land? They're not in the land. They've been taken from the land. This promise is not being currently fulfilled. Are they a people when they are taken to captivity? They are, right? There are people in captivity, but they are still a people. And are they being blessed and blessing the earth? It's complicated. You know, if you think of what happens to the people in Daniel's circle, some of those people really are blessed because Daniel is there. But the land thing is, that's the thing that jumps out, like, the Lord has to fix this. This is a problem. And so when you get to Daniel's prayer in Daniel chapter 9, that's what he's aware of. For 70 years, we've been out of the land. Now it's time for us to go back, like he promised. So that's the Abraham piece. And then you get the Moses piece, 1500 BC-ish. What's the big thing we get with Moses? We get the law, yep. Covenant of Moses. The big thing there is the law. And the land and the law are connected, because basically how you stay in the land and how you maintain the blessing is by fulfilling the law, by being obedient to the law. Not perfectly. You don't have to be perfectly obedient, because there's grace in the law, in the time of the law when you sin, right? There's sacrifices you can offer. But the law, a big deal. So when you violate the law, when you are no longer fulfilling the law, when you're no longer keeping that covenant, the Lord removes you from the land. That's how that works. So why do they go into captivity? Ultimately, they go into captivity because they are not keeping the covenant of the law. And so the people in the book of Daniel, the ones who are honored, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, those are men who keep the law. They keep the covenant of the law. Even though they're in Babylon, they're keeping the law. And so the times where they choose to keep the law and not the law of Nebuchadnezzar, they are honored in really significant ways. So that's the land, that's the law. And then you get 1000 BC, who's the big figure connected to that? David. Yeah, so there we get the covenant of the king. That's kind of an interesting one. So God promises to David, you will have a son who will reign forever. And then he also has this other promise in, this is 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 14 or so. You will have a son who will reign forever, and if he is if he's faithful to me, then I will be faithful to him. He will be a son to me, I will be a father to him. Ultimately, we know that's fulfilled in Christ, but that promise of a king is a big deal. So that for hundreds of years, there's kings, Davidic kings who reign over Israel. But then the people are taken to Babylon. No longer is there a Davidic king reigning over the people of God. Big deal. That's a very big deal. And then they get back to Jerusalem in 538 under Cyrus. And there's still no king. So when you read Ezra 1 through 6, that's basically describing this return and then the rebuilding of the temple. There's still no king. And when you get to all these centuries here before Christ, there's still no Davidic king reigning over the throne. So it's really all a big setup for Jesus. Jesus, who's not just the king, but he is the Davidic. He's the Davidic king. So that all that brings, it helps you see just how dark the dark time was of captivity. So you're not in the land. You are a people, but you're not a people under the king, which is what you're supposed to be. And you're not experiencing the full blessing of God that you were supposed to receive. So that's getting oriented to when Daniel is happening and kind of why it's a big deal. So in Daniel 1, why is Daniel in Babylon? We've answered that. How long were they to stay? We've answered that. And those verses there, Jeremiah 25, 11 and 12, 29, 10, 11, those are verses that promise 70 years. So you're going to be in Babylon for 70 years, but then I will bring you back.
Is there any correlation between 70 and the number 7? Because 7 is perfection.
I think so. I think there is some kind of picture of kind of a complete punishment or a complete act of discipline and judgment of God. But that's all I could say. But yeah, definitely anytime something is seven times something, then yes, there's probably some pointer back to seven. So when you get to Daniel's 70 weeks in Daniel chapter 9, that has those kinds of allusions too. And maybe we'll explain that later. All right, so how long do they stay in Babylon? 70 years, we said that. In the opening chapter, you get all these tests, right? So Daniel and his friends, his three amigos, are consistently tested to compromise, or tempted to compromise. And so the first compromise is that they're going to eat the delicacies offered to them by Nebuchadnezzar. And so what is their response to that temptation? They say no. Daniel 1:8, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. And so he ate only what he had determined would be acceptable according to the law of Moses or some kind of standard. And so the guard that's watching over these three guys is actually a little bit nervous because he knows that if these guys don't do well, that life for him doesn't go well. And so but Daniel is he's not just brave and godly, but he's also wise. And so he understands the predicament that the guard is in. So he basically says, just test it for a while. We're going to eat according to our own religious convictions. And if we do well, great. And if we don't do well, I don't know what. And so they test him, and then how are they described? Verse 15. So at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So even though they were eating only vegetables, that's terrible, isn't it? You're eating only vegetables, but yet you're fatter than all your friends. This is not good. What's that?
Maybe everyone is just twigs.
Yes, that's true. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So their reward for that is they're given vegetables. But it is the Lord's provision, right? So they take a hard stand that could have cost them their lives, and they're honored for it. And then you get the natural gifting that these guys have, because they are clearly gifted in their intellect, and so you don't want to say, well, that's because they're godly. That's not what's being said here. They were gifted in their intellects. And so when you get to verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And so at the end of the time, they chose Daniel and his three amigos to be these esteemed figures in the royal court. So that's a good thing to remember. So these are godly, brave young men who have a high standing in Nebuchadnezzar's court. So who are the other godly Israelites who have a high standing in kind of a secular king's court? Yeah, absolutely. Joseph, right? Second in command to Pharaoh. Yeah, so in the book of Genesis, you get that? And what's the result of Joseph having that esteemed position?
He was able to protect the land by interpreting Pharaoh's dream.
Yeah, so the people survived a famine. So they had to leave the land, which is interesting, and go to Egypt, but the people that were promised to Abraham survived that famine because of Joseph being in that place. So there's one huge one. What's another figure who has a high standing in a secular king's court?
Esther.
Great. Esther, yeah. So she becomes the queen to Xerxes, right? Or is it Artaxerxes? Or is it Ahasuerus? I always forget the name. I think it's Xerxes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so because she's in that privileged position, what's the great consequence? The Jews are saved. So once again, the Jews are saved because there's someone in a secular king's court. There's two. Who's another?
Nehemiah.
Excellent. Nehemiah, yeah. You guys keep not saying the person I'm thinking of, but you keep adding to my list. Yeah, so Nehemiah, cupbearer to the king, the Artaxerxes. And the result of that is what? It's a little more complicated, but... Yeah, it helps rebuild the wall with the king's support, financing, and protection. Yeah. Yeah, so he was noble and brave, honorable, respected in the court, and so he got that kind of treatment. So another big Old Testament figure. David, that is true. Well, not a secular king, though, so he's in Saul's court, right? Although he did have that weird time among the Philistines, where he was sort of trying to win them favor and fight on their behalf, but then he was killing Philistines. That was weird. Yeah, so Moses would be, that's the guy I was looking for. So Moses. So, yeah, there's not a lot written about Moses. I understand why you wouldn't think of him. Yeah, so he's in Pharaoh's court. He's not, that part of Moses' life isn't given a lot of detail, so maybe that's why you didn't think of it. But he was there for 40 years, right? So as a child, he's brought to the queen. He's raised in Pharaoh's palace. And then he goes out in to see his fellow people, sees an Egyptian kill an Israelite, kills the Egyptian, and then he has to run for 40 years. But if you think about the story of the Exodus, what's the result of Moses being in the court of Pharaoh? This is a little bit speculative, kind of reading between the lines, but what's the result of Moses being in the court of Pharaoh?
He's able to, like, plead with the king. I mean, Pharaoh knows him when he comes back. He's like, I know who you are. He's probably a little more likely to listen.
Yeah, so, I mean, what you guys are saying is exactly right. So he has standing in the palace because he's a known person. He knows their culture, and they know him. And so it's him going to appeal to Pharaoh. It's not like just any old Israelite going to appeal to Pharaoh. So he's, in some ways, he's appealing a bit as a peer to the others in the court. So the Lord has his ways of moving national affairs just so he can get his person in the right place at the right time. And all throughout the Bible, we see that. So the fact that the people are in captivity to a foreign power, I mean, they're, you know, it would be, you know, in some ways it would be like if we were Guatemala and we were taken captive to some nation that was basically Russia and China combined, right? So in that situation, you would say it's absolutely, totally impossible that one of us Guatemalans are going to find our way into the court of this China-Russia empire. And yet that's exactly what happens. God just keeps doing it. He keeps putting his people at the right hand of the ruler so that his people will be protected in various ways. I mean, God can protect his people miraculously, right? He doesn't need that to happen, but yet he often uses sort of practical means to accomplish his supernatural purposes. All right, so that's chapter 1. So chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and we already referred to this. So he has this dream, and he gives his wise men this famous test. He wants them to interpret his dream, but what's the key challenge? They have to tell him the dream first. And so if you're a dream interpreter for someone like Nebuchadnezzar, who often kills people he doesn't like, you would not appreciate that little wrinkle, because now you can't just wax eloquent and just make up cool stuff about the dream. Now you have to actually produce, right? And so so Daniel hears about this challenge that the Lord, that the king has thrown down. And so he thinks, well, I can't do it, but the Lord can. And so then he says, so then he gets the interpretation, and then he says this great thing in chapter 2, verse 20. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Great prayer. There's the book of Daniel has maybe a dozen or two dozen of these proclamations, these prayers or statements of praise, which are truly amazing. So if you want to have a good passage of scripture to pray over, there's a ton of them in the book of Daniel. All right. So then we get this statue. So I've written down the pieces of the statue here on page one of the outline. So you've got this head of fine gold. So here's our head of fine gold. And then you've got these chests and arms of silver. This is our chest and arms of silver. And so we'll just put G here for gold, and this is silver, silver, silver. And then we get to our middle and thighs of bronze. Our bronze thighs, and then we get to our legs of iron. And then we get to our feet. That's it, right? Oh, yeah, feet partly of iron, partly of clay. So iron and clay. So that's exactly what the statue was like that Daniel saw. So, just to state the obvious, what do you notice about the descending materials other than what? No, sorry. What do you notice about the descending materials, top to bottom? They keep descending. They get less valuable, less valuable, less value. Yeah, so you start with gold, you go to silver, go to bronze, go to iron, and then you go to iron and clay. All right. But what we learn is that these are... So we're given the interpretation this time. We get beasts later in the book. We're not always told what the beast represents, but in the case of the statue, this is Nebuchadnezzar. And then we get the Medes and the Persians. Then we get the silver, which is... Whoops, I meant to do P. The Medes and the Persians. So do we remember any of the Persian leaders from the Bible?
Cyrus
is kind of just, yeah, that's a big one you want to remember. So then we get to our Greek bronze thighs, which is, we'll do Greek. So this is kind of a pop quiz. So big figure in ancient history. He was a Greek, massively successful military champion. Alexander the Great. Yeah. So Alexander the Great actually does kind of make an appearance in the book of Daniel. Which is very amazing because of why?
Because we also have other historical accounts of him, this great empire.
That is true. So we know what his empire was really like ultimately. But why is it amazing that it's, why is it particularly amazing that it's in the book of Daniel? Yeah, because Daniel happened before Alexander the Great, hundreds of years before Alexander the Great. So the fact that it's prophesied there is relatively amazing. And so you get these, so that's chapter 2. When you get to 7 through 12, the apocalyptic part where the beasts are talked about, the way that those beasts are talked about lines up with world history in a really remarkable way. So that's why, you know, secular skeptical interpreters are going to look at Daniel and say, well, obviously it was written, you know, like in 100 BC or something, but it wasn't. It was written long before that. So these are amazing things. And so then you get to iron, which is, we're told it's Rome. So the Roman Empire, big and mighty. But that big and mighty empire will one day fall because it's got feet of clay. They can't support the weight of this massive gold, silver, bronze, iron statue that we've constructed. So, but that's not the end of the story, though. Because there's something that happens. If you turn to chapter 2, verse 40, we'll start at 42. Now we can start our reading. So, David, once you start, and again, we'll do one verse per person, and we'll just do 42 to 45. So, Daniel 2:42 to 45. Now is a good time.
And as the toes of the feet were partially iron and partially clay, so the kingdom shall be partially strong and partially brittle.
As you saw the iron mixed with the soft clay, they will also mix with one another in marriage. They will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay.
And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break into pieces all of these kingdoms and bring them to an end. It shall stand forever.
Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's this other... how do I want to do this? I'll just write rock. Although I should have put it up on top. Yeah, so basically this tells us you get world history, right? So you start Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon in the 500s BC. You work your way all the way to the Roman Empire, which I don't know when that starts. What is it, 70 BC, something like that, 100 BC? It lasts for hundreds of years, but it ultimately collapses, right? But there's this other thing, this rock, which is importantly, how is it described? Cut from a mountain by no human hand. So this rock, this mighty rock, which is going to establish this kingdom, which will never end, is cut by no human hand. So obviously we know it's Christ, right? It's divine. And so that's going to crush all of these other all of these other empires ultimately, and then last forever. And so the other thing about that promise is that it's not just a man, it's not just a king that's being described here, but it's a people, right? So, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. So it's a kingdom, right? It's a kingdom with a people, and there's not any other people that are going to destroy this people. And so we are part of that people, right? So we are in the kingdom of God, in the kingdom of heaven, through our King, the Lord Jesus Christ. So that's quite amazing. So, you know, you read along in that prophecy, you're kind of, it's a little bit tricky to track all the details, but then when you step back and see what's being said here, that's pretty amazing. You know, that a book could describe world history so accurately. And then so helpfully, because what you realize is that the kingdom we're a part of is going to be there forever, you know, long after all the kingdoms of the earth are a distant memory. The kingdom of God is going to remain, and we are a part of that kingdom. So then you get the first of these, and we've already touched on this a couple times, but the first of these kind of somewhat bizarre but inspiring statements by Nebuchadnezzar. So, you know, verse 47, chapter 2, verse 47. So King Nebuchadnezzar recognizes Daniel has not only told him the dream, but he's given the interpretation, or not just given the interpretation, but told him the dream, whichever way you want to frame it. Both are amazing. So the king answers and said to Daniel, "Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." And then he is esteemed and awarded, rewarded, and along with his three amigos, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So Daniel remained at the king's court. So his, you know, three friends are esteemed and elevated, but he himself has a special closeness to the king himself. But that statement of Nebuchadnezzar, "Your God is God of gods and Lord of lords." Now, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar is surely thinking that, you know, my God and your God can sort of, we can both have a place in the world, the visible and invisible world. But your God, I recognize, is bigger than my God. But both gods can exist. You know, he doesn't go all the way, which is to say your God is the only God. But he does say that your God is the God of gods and Lord of lords. All right, so that's chapter 2. Then we get to chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego now have their epic tests. So obviously at this point, Nebuchadnezzar, this is one of his bad days where he says, "I want worship." And he says, "How about we just build a statue and people bow down and worship the statue. And anyone who doesn't worship the statue is going to be killed." So the Jews will not do that. Well, this is a conspiracy, right? No, I was right. And so the Jews, you know, at this point they've more or less learned their lesson. I mean, one of the reasons they're in captivity in the first place is because they kept building statues and bowing down to the statues. They would be like Moab. So they would be marrying women from Moab, or they would be doing business with people from Moab, and they would bring the gods of Moab into their own houses, and they would worship the gods of Moab, and they wouldn't think anything about it. And so that was breaking the covenant that the Lord had made with his people, and so that's why they were in Babylon. So when they were in Babylon, they more or less had learned their lesson that we shouldn't bow down to false gods. And so they keep, part of the testing throughout Daniel is that God's people would bow down to false gods, and they don't. And so here again, they're forced on pain of death to bow down to false gods, and they don't. And then when you get to verse 16, you know, there's a trial. Nebuchadnezzar's furious that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego won't play along with his little game. And then we get to verse 16, and let's read 16 to 25. So where do we stop? Oh, I'll go stop. So, Rufus.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter.
If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king.
But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.
Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated.
And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace.
And these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace.
Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Then second row, you are at verse 23.
Do we not cast 3 men bound into the fire? They answered and said to the king, True, O king.
He answered and said, But I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods.
So then the 3 men are pulled out of the fire. They're not even singed a little bit. Their clothes don't smell like smoke, that whole deal. And so then Esther, start at verse 28, and we'll read to verse 30.
Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's commands, and yielded up their bodies, rather than serve and worship any god except their own god.
Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way.
Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Excellent. So if we go back to verses 16 and 17, what's amazing about the statement that those 3 men make? Yeah.
And your idols aren't powerful either.
Yeah. So they just have a very clear, strong sense of who God is, who their God is, and who the God of the Babylonians is. Definitely.
They also claim that if God doesn't choose to deliver them, they would still not worship the
God. Yeah. Yeah, they know that God can deliver them. He's powerful enough to deliver them. They know the history of Israel. God had delivered his people miraculously many, many times. And so they know that God can deliver them, but they don't actually know that he will deliver them. They don't have that kind of, you know, sometimes you just have a prophetic sense, God's going to deliver us. They don't have that. But even if he doesn't, they're not going to bow down to the false God of Nebuchadnezzar. So it's a very powerful statement. So, you know, clearly they're willing to face death rather than bow down to a false God. And so they face their punishment. They get thrown into the fire. And then that strange fourth person shows up there alongside them, never explained. But, you know, in some ways, kind of like the assurance of the Lord, maybe the protection of the Lord that he's with us. He is with us in the fire. You know, you've heard that said maybe. And that's what it's getting at. He is with us in the fire furnace. We may have to go into the fire furnace and we may die in the fiery furnace, but even if we are there, he's with us. And then you get another statement by Nebuchadnezzar, sort of his growing sense of Yahweh and their God. And so this time he says in verse 28, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants. Therefore, I make a decree that anyone who speaks against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. There's some great punishments in the Bible. If you're trying to think of how to really punish someone for doing something, torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. So once again, he is recognizing that the God of these Israelites is not a God to mess around with. And then you get chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar has his time of wandering around like a cow eating grass in a field for 7 years. And amazingly, when he has his mind restored, he still is able to go back and rule over the kingdom. Somehow they kind of saved his place there. That's as miraculous as anything. And when he comes back into his right mind and recognizes once again who God is, well, he has an even more amazing statement about the Lord. This is chapter 4, verses 34 and 35. We'll go to the end. 34 to 37. So we left off. So David's back to you, verse 34.
Nebuchadnezzar lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation.
And what chapter is this?
Chapter 4, verse 35.
All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. None can stay his hand or say to him, "What have you done?"
At the same time, my reason has returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty, my splendor, returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me.
Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble.
Excellent. Yeah, a couple things to notice about these statements of faith or worship by Nebuchadnezzar. So one is how often there are to references to king or kingdom, dominion, words like that. So this is a king, obviously, over a very powerful nation, Babylon at the time, massively powerful at the time. So he understands power, he understands kingdoms, and he understands when he is encountering a king with an even greater kingdom. And so, again, this is Nebuchadnezzar talking. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. So that's one thing. And then the other thing to notice, which is fascinating, is kind of the growth of Nebuchadnezzar, if you can say that. So before he says, "Your God is greater than all gods," and then he passes the law, "No one may speak against this God." And then now he kind of elevates him. His growth seems even more clear because he does what? What in these verses makes you think now this is an even greater expression of his growth? Yeah, now he himself is praising and extolling and honoring the King of Heaven. Yeah. And so he's not just allowing other people to do that, but he himself is praising and honoring and extolling. And so we don't know what kind of quote-unquote conversion Nebuchadnezzar had, but something was happening there, right? All right, so now we get to chapter 5. We'll skip that. Go to chapter 6, which is so amazing, but we actually don't really have time to cover it. But a similar kind of situation where there's a challenge thrown out. So this is Darius, and the strange thing about this Darius is it isn't Darius the Great, whom you might recall from, there's Cyrus, and then after Cyrus comes Darius the Great, and it's under Darius the Great that the temple is rebuilt. So you might think that's the Darius being talked about, but it's not. It's another Darius that is somewhat confusing, and we're not sure actually who it is. But it's the guy that Daniel was reporting to at this time. And so this is where the satraps are jealous of Daniel. They conspire together. Hey, force people not to pray to any other god. Is that the gauntlet? Yeah, not to pray to any other god. And so Daniel just says, no, I'm not going to do that. So he opens his window, which is kind of amazing, right? And he just kneels down in prayer. And he's not being flashy as he does that. The point there is that he's doing what he always does. So he's not showing off by praying in this bold way. It's just, you know, there's this challenge, and yet he determines that, no, I'm gonna keep doing what I've always done, which is pray to Yahweh as I always do. And so he, as a result, is thrown into thrown into the lion's den. There's kind of a touching scene where Darius is trying to intervene, but Darius realizes that, you know, so he sort of gets his own hastiness, maybe. He gets caught in his own hastiness. He had hastily affirmed this law, which he, in the case of Daniel, wanted to violate, but he couldn't because it was a law of the Medes and Persians, and it could not be broken. So Daniel's thrown into the lion's den. Obviously, famously, he's not eaten by the lions. And then Daniel's rescued the next day, the Lord's almighty hand, and kind of the salvation of God is made very evident. So basically, Daniel's brought up, and then the guys who conspired against Daniel are thrown into the lion's den. And even before they hit the ground, the lions attack and kill them and destroy them. And then once again, you have this statement by a secular king in verse 25 through 27. I'll read this one. So then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. It's a great, great word of praise. All right, so the finish here. So back in chapter 2, we heard about this rock, right? This rock that was going to destroy all the kingdoms of the earth and last forever and be a king and a kingdom that would last forever. And then when you get to chapter 7, you get four beasts. Now we're into the apocalyptic part. And apocalyptic is a word that describes a certain kind of literature in our Bibles. And it's basically, you tell stories it's kind of a show me, don't tell me. So that you get a description of a picture which is held up to us, or a description of a scene that's held up to us. And the point of it is the images that are being kind of portrayed for us convey the meaning. You know, sometimes, like in that passage I just read, he is the living God enduring forever, right? So that's the words describe, it's a tell me. It's telling you how great Yahweh is. But when you get to chapter 7, you get these images that convey how great, how awesome our God is. And so that's apocalyptic literature. It's often telling things that happen in the future. You know, there's monsters, there's beasts. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings. It's being described in front of you, right? Except it's true. Although I suppose Lord of the Rings is true in its own way. But when you get to chapter 7, so you get this series of beasts. So you get a lion, you get a bear, you get a leopard, and then you get a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth, 10 horns. So in some ways, you actually get the same progression again. So you get, if the lion is Nebuchadnezzar, the bear is the Medes and the Persians, the leopard is the Greeks, kind of captured, you know, the Alexander the Great in this. One of the things he was famous for is very speedy in his attacks and destruction. But then you get the fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful. So that would be Rome. 10 horns, so the Roman emperors as they succeeded. But then you get to chapter, then you get the middle of the chapter, though, and this is, so the now we get a vision of God himself. So 7, 9 through 14. So as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took a seat. So we've been talking about these beasts, and they're kind of impressive in their own way, but now the Ancient of Days takes a seat. So he's alone in his greatness. His clothing was white as snow. So what would be the significance of white clothing? Yeah, pure, unblemished. So that's what's happening in this kind of in apocalyptic literature. The things like colors or numbers become really significant. So his clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was like pure wool. And that's, think of an old man. So, like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. So power, purity, destruction, judgment flowing out from him. 1,000 thousands served him. So how many is 1,000,000? Yeah, it's a million. So if a thousand thousands served him, 10,000 times 10,000. I won't ask you how big that is. That's a big number, stood before him. These are millions and millions of people before the Lord. The court sat in judgment and the books were opened. So the books of all the deeds of the people are there, and the court sat in judgment over all the deeds of the world. So then I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed as if it was just nothing. This mighty beast that had raised up, and we thought it was a problem, but it's just killed. Hardly even a mention. And its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Who are we talking about there? Yeah, the Lord Jesus Christ, who often referred to himself as Son of Man. So that phrase, Son of Man, pops up maybe 50 times in the Gospels. So Jesus, sometimes in a sort of, it's not deceptive, but sort of in a clever way, which is both revealing and hiding, he would talk about himself as the Son of Man, pointing back, though, to this passage. He is that guy. That's what Jesus was saying. And so he is the one who has an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So he is the king that shall reign forever, that is promised in the book of Daniel. That's what's being told to us in the words of Jesus, the deeds of Jesus. And so it's interesting, too, that he's both, you have the Ancient of Days, God the Father, on the throne, and then you have the Son of Man brought before the Ancient of Days. And so in some ways, Jesus, the Son of Man, is distinct from the Ancient of Days, but Jesus is also distinct from all creation. So nothing else in creation, visible or invisible creation, angels, demons, kings of the earth, whatever, nothing is like Christ. And yet, Christ and the Father are distinguished. You don't want to say that Jesus is lower than the Father, but he did have a purpose that required him to condescend from his throne in heaven and accomplish that purpose. So pop quiz. So that opening line there, and this will be the last thing I say. So the opening line there, behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. Do you remember when that's talked about in our New Testaments? Good. So Revelation, and also in the Olivet Discourses, when Jesus, in the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when Jesus is describing the end of times, he refers to the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. But in those, so in other words, that's a future time, that's the eschaton, the last things which are coming. So, all right, So a lot wrapped up there in the book of Daniel. All right, so next class is the last class, I'm sorry to say. We'll do the book of Jonah and then begin our summer breaks. Oh, yeah, writing assignments, yep. Yeah, pass them down this way.